I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. As the Republicans gathered last night in Milwaukee for debate number 4, Chris Christie and Mike Huckabee were relegated to the kiddie table. Lindsey Graham wasn't even invited to dinner. Are national polls the best way to decide who's in and who's out? And who gets to decide? We'll ask the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist E.R. Shipp from Morgan State University, Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland, and Republican blogger Richard Cross. Then, a conversation with Ellis Marsalis. He'll be helping the Reginald F. Lewis Museum celebrate their 10th birthday this weekend. He's been helping jazz musicians, including his own sons, celebrate this great American art form for more than 40 years. Tom Pelton puts the environment in focus. Nathan Sterner's got the local news. First, the national headlines.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. On this Veterans Day, we send our best wishes to veterans and their families with deep gratitude for your service. The Republicans held their fourth debate of this election cycle last night. 8 candidates on the main bill, followed 4 on the early card. It was held in Milwaukee, which bills itself as the birthplace of the Republican Party, and it was held to some extent in the shadow of the last Republican debate, in which the moderators from CNBC drew the ire of the candidates and many observers as well. Reporters from Fox Business News and the Wall Street Journal asked the questions last night. We'll ask this question this morning. How did it go? Was it more or less substantive than the previous debates? And helping us to explore some answers, E.R. Shipp. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and an associate professor and journalist in residence in the Morgan State University School of Global Journalism and Communication. Dr. Sherry Parks, a longtime friend of this station and our show, is an associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm very pleased we have Shipp and Sherry here. Right? I'm delighted that you're both here. That's great.
Sounds like a singing duo.
Right, it does. You know, we'll have you breaking into song in no time. So, Shipp, Neil Cavuto, one of the moderators of the debate at the very end, right before they signed off, said it was about them, pointing to the candidates, not us, as a clear demarcation between this one and the CNBC affair. What do you think? Was he right?
He was right, I think. To a large degree, these reporters who were asking the questions this time actually came with serious questions. They didn't try to come up with cute questions. They didn't play to pop culture. They pretty much stuck to the advertised plan to talk about the economy and spinoffs of economic questions.
Yeah. Sherry Parks, is this a media story? I mean, a lot of folks tried to make that the narrative since the CNBC debate, where it was about the tone of the questions, you know, the way they were phrased, the gotcha, dimension of them. Is that, in fact, the story? Is that the right narrative we should have been thinking about this week?
Well, I think it's interesting that we're asking ourselves, what is the narrative? Because I think that's the issue, the meta-narrative, is that there's so many people and so many people trying to make their own narratives that we don't know what the master narrative is. There's no, and that's a problem for the Republican Party. And to the degree, it's easier to make the media the narrative because we know them. You know, we know what they're going to do, and they're not so many surprises. I do think the moderators were part of the story last night. I mean, there was, you know, people were calling Jerry. I mean, they were playing to the moderator, particularly one. Yeah, I think from the Wall Street Journal, particularly hard, right?
So yeah, that's Jerry Baker, who's the managing editor.
Who doesn't seem to call himself Jerry, but
yeah. Gerard Baker,
right. And so I think there was some of that going on, and there was some attempt to kind of this is a trivial question once or twice. But for the most part, yes, the media stayed out of its own story.
So by and large, did either of you hear any sort of, you know, heavily biased questions? I mean, in other words, are the moderators last night at all susceptible to the same kind of criticism that the CNBC moderators had?
Well, I don't necessarily buy into the fact that the CNBC was necessarily biased. The candidates didn't agree with the questions or the tone of the questions, and they changed the narrative on that.
Kelce DePriese, they didn't like the questions.
But this time around, I I didn't really detect much there. They weren't. They knew their audience. It was Fox News, after all. So they didn't have to go out of the way to prove any particular points. They knew who they were dealing with.
I agree that it was Fox. And so sometimes the way the questions were set up displayed a very conservative bias. You know, the country is in shambles and that sort of thing. But they were playing to their audience, too.
After the CNBC debate, Ted Cruz went so far as to say that if you've never in your life voted in a Republican Party primary, you shouldn't be moderating a Republican primary debate. And my question is, isn't there a role to some extent for partisanship in the debates that are sponsored by the individual parties? In other words, these are Republican primary debates. So, and the Democrats, the same thing. They are inherently partisan because they're just one. This is not a general election debate. I don't think anybody would suggest that, general election debates should be partisan. But in the primaries themselves, what is the role of the parties? And is there a valid place for partisanship?
Well, the primaries are for the parties and for party members, but they are using public airwaves to get their messages across in these debates. So while they have a narrative that they want us to hear, I think the moderators are coming in trying to be journalists who are impartial. We shouldn't know how they vote when they do go into those voting booths. That should not be apparent in any of the questions that they raise. Sometimes it's skewed, as you mentioned before, because the Fox News questioners will probably be asking questions from a more conservative perspective. But that's no guarantee that they're not Democrats or Republicans either. They just may be asking the kinds of questions that audience wants to hear.
Mm-hmm. I think this is an interesting moment because, of course, the whole idea of journalism objectivity was created by the Associated Press and UPI to sell lots of papers. And that idea of journalists taking objectivity pills is an old joke. And now the United States is moving to be more like Britain, where we know the political standpoint of the journalist. There was a really interesting moment that went around the debate with, for a lot of viewers who don't watch Fox News, of Lou Dobbs, who left CNN because of his rants around immigration. And last night he appeared, rested and ready, looking years younger than he did in 2009 when he left CNN, as a stand-up, straight-ahead journalist and so the idea that journalists can be ideologues at the same time, I think, is interesting for the mainstream of American media.
What about the parties themselves and the role that they play in influencing the format, the questioners, the venue, all that stuff? I mean, should the networks have as much control and influence as they appear to have about when the debates are going to take place, who's going to moderate them? I mean, these are party affairs, but a lot of folks have complained that, you know, for example, CNN in the very first one had to make a call. There were 490 people running for president in the Republican Party. They had to winnow that down to a state, you know, to people who would fit on the stage. So they came up with a somewhat arbitrary bar that people had to pass in terms of national polls. Should that decision be in the hands of producers at CNN as opposed to the parties themselves or somebody else?
I think in this case, each side needs the other. So they end up negotiating to some extent. The journalism side doesn't make the decisions without some consultation. They may not ultimately agree on all the final details, but they do reach some kind of agreement because the networks are kind of competing with each other to see who can pull this off better. And then the parties, of course, need the airwaves to have their candidates exposed. So there's a role for the media to determine what works best for that medium, but they are in negotiation with the parties.
There's the absence of a third party. Sometimes in debates, there's a third supposedly neutral party that mediates, and that role, which is a junior league or whoever, is not here. And with the entrance of Trump and the amount of money that's being made, debates used to be the way networks lost money but got prestige. Now the ratings have shot through the roof, the stakes are higher. Notice what we're saying. We're saying that the media might need to abdicate its role as this seemingly, or at least trying to be, neutral party. And I think that's dangerous.
Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland. E.R. Shipp is here as well. She's at Morgan State University. We're talking about the Republican debate last night on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall, and you're listening to Maryland Morning. What about the formulas that they've chosen to use, national polls as opposed to local polls in places like Iowa and New Hampshire, where the first primaries and caucuses are taking place? The polls are famously a bad predictor of who's going to actually win the nomination ultimately. The election is less than a year away. I mean, do you have any thoughts, Shipp, about what the formula might be that, you know, would say it's a valid thing to not have Lindsey Graham and George Pataki to even be part of the conversation last night?
You do have to winnow out some of those many candidates, that's for sure. But it seems to me that by only relying upon the national polls, you're not really paying attention to what's happening in those states where the candidates are really contesting right now. So Iowa, New Hampshire, I think these same candidates, the lineup will be different if we were looking at how they were polling in those states. So I'm not sure what the answer is, but I think the national polls don't necessarily tell you how well the candidates are doing on the ground where they really are campaigning right now.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there's this whole notion of, you know, we're yet again in another cycle where states like Iowa and New Hampshire, which are just overwhelmingly white, are, you know, setting the tone, calling the shots for the first months and months and months of this contest.
I saw that when there were shots of the audience last night, and they were, not only were they largely white, they were largely male, which I thought was really interesting. I think there's a subtext of the popular vote versus the Electoral College, and one of the candidates actually mentioned that last night. And we now technologically have the ability to just have a straight national election without the caucuses and everything. And I'm wondering if this is the beginning of that conversation.
Yeah, well, that was a conversation that Mrs. Clinton brought up even as far ago as 2008. Yeah. Well, we will continue this after a break for news. Thank you so much. And we'll be right back. After a break, as I say, we'll have more with E.R. Shipp from Morgan State University's School of Global Journalism and Communication and Dr. Sherry Parks from the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland. We'll also be joined by Richard Cross. He's a former speechwriter for Governor Bob Ehrlich. But first, we will send it back to Nathan Stern.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall, continuing our conversation now about the fourth Republican debate of the 2016 election cycle with E.R. Shipp, an associate professor and journalist in residence in the Morgan State University School of Global Journalism and Communication. She's also a Pulitzer Prize winner. And Dr. Sherry Parks is here. She's associate dean in the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland. Richard Cross joins the table as well. Good to see you, Richard. How are you?
Good to be here.
He is the former press secretary and speechwriter for Bob Ehrlich when he was in Congress and when he served as governor of Maryland. His blog is called Cross Purposes. So, Richard, how do we think, do we think about a front runner right now? The polls are saying that, you know, it's Carson and Trump sort of neck and neck. But after last night's conversation, do you think anybody emerged as a winner and as a potential front runner at this point?
I still think it's a very dynamic set of circumstances. I think if you were to pick a name, I think Ben Carson did very well last night, and I think he's the nominal front runner. But I think you've got Marco Rubio kind of looking over his shoulder. I think Trump is not quite the dominant figure in this race as he once was. I don't think people are as scared of him on the stage anymore. And I think he's not kind of sucking up all the oxygen the way, and other candidates are kind of finally getting their messages out.
And people have attributed that to the fact that they're starting to talk about policy. And the minute they start actually talking about actual stuff, Mr. Trump fades.
He wings it. He wings it.
I mean, everybody's a disaster. Everybody's
stupid. He can come in with the one-liners.
Yeah. We're not winning, But what does that mean when it comes to foreign policy or
Or he says things that are dangerous. I mean, when he starts calling out China and North Korea and saying, almost evil axis kinds of things, that is a little frightening.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about Dr. Carson, who, of course, had a distinguished career as a surgeon here in Baltimore. In previous debates, he was kind of mild-mannered and not combative in the style of Trump. Do we think he was on the defensive at all last night? Chip, what do you think? I mean, he'd had a kind of a rough week in terms of people, paying close attention to some of the things he's written about in his autobiographies, et cetera.
I was actually surprised that he was not required, I guess, to respond more than he did. He was given kind of a softball question about what had been going on, questioning of his credentials.
Yeah, let's take a second and listen to that. Actually, we have it.
First of all, thank you for not asking me what I said in the 10th grade. I appreciate that.
But I'll just forget that follow-up.
The fact of the matter is, what we should vet all candidates. I have no problem with being vetted. What I do have a problem with is being lied about and then putting that out there as truth. And I don't even mind that so much if they do it about with everybody, like people on the other side. But when I look at somebody like Hillary Clinton, who sits there and tells her daughter and a government official that, no, this was a terrorist attack, and then tells everybody else that it was a video. Where I came from, they call that a lie. And
so, Chip, there's some stuff in there that doesn't quite stand up to scrutiny.
Very much so, and that tends to be his style. And so when we start looking into what he's saying, he can easily say, well, you're holding me up to greater scrutiny than you are to anybody else. He got away with it last night. And it's easy to say, well, Hillary Clinton lies also and win applause from that audience. But he still never has addressed the questions that have been raised about his honesty. He ended that whole piece, I think, by saying something like, anybody who knows me knows I'm an honest person. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't address the questions about whether he's exaggerated some of his key life moments.
And is it significant that none of the other candidates on the stage took the opportunity to push back? I mean, Mr. Cavuto didn't take that opportunity, but, other people could have.
Well, and certainly we have to ask whether this is racial, whether there's been a lot of conversation about, when Trump started to go after him and then backed off over the last couple of weeks. I mean, they don't want to be seen as picking on the black guy, which, of course, I can't play in a presidential election. He starts, though, Carson does, when he's asked that question, talking about his 3-year-old daughter who's in the audience, almost as if to say, you can't.
His granddaughter. Yeah.
Granddaughter,
yeah,
thank right. you. You can't be mean to me with my granddaughter in the audience. And then he clearly is working to deflect any attempt to talk about his
background.
Yeah,
so his story of his granddaughter and Mrs. Clinton is protection.
Can
yeah, right, yeah, who
right.
can get
that's high behind the women.
So Richard Cross, there's a woman at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, a scholar named Leah Wright Rigger, who wrote a book called The Loneliness of the Black Republican. Mm-hmm. Are Republicans, do you think, in this cycle, any more welcoming, any more open to an African-American dimension of their party? And is that, if that's so, is that because of Dr. Carson?
Unfortunately, I think there's still kind of a pervasive cynicism among Republicans as to whether or not they can attract African-American voters. Dr. Carson's kind of an interesting phenomenon because he's this individual with this great life experience, and he's coming into the kind of the political kind of universe at a time where people are interested in candidates with non-traditional backgrounds. You've got the celebrity candidate, Donald Trump. You've got this brilliant doctor who's running as a Republican. And the party tends to be very kind of hierarchical and elevating people that are establishment figures. And I think Dr. Carson, either because of his race or in spite of his race, is a non-traditional candidate. And I think that's why people are That's where his appeal is coming from.
It seems to me that even the Black Lives Matter movement has made it clear that the so-called black vote, in quotes, is not a monolithic thing that should be taken for granted. I mean, they have gone to great lengths to interrupt events at Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. There was a poll that came out Monday from Quinnipiac, renowned polling organization that says that Carson leads Clinton in a hypothetical matchup by 10 votes or 10 points rather, and a significant reason is that Carson appears to be taking away a chunk of the African American support that Mrs. Clinton currently enjoys, perhaps as much as 20%. How is that racial factor going to play in on the Republican side?
I'm surprised at that number, but Carson is appealing to not just conservatives, but Christian conservatives. And if you know anything about black people in this country, they, more than any other group, consider themselves to be people of faith, mostly Christian. And they tend to be conservative if they are religious. They're conservative in a lot of ways. They may be seen as more liberal when it comes to demanding civil rights, but in their lifestyles, perhaps they're a little bit more conservative. So they may be attracted to a Ben Carson for that reason. Some people are attracted to him because of that life story of having overcome adversity. If that story falls apart, though, some of that support that's based on that may also fall apart.
And Sherry Parks, this is all taking place in the context of what was going on just yesterday and the day before at University of Missouri.
Well, and I think last night for me was a bit of a surreal experience, because as the campus was dealing with death threats from somebody who said, "I'm coming to campus to kill black people," this debate went on in which, you know, Ben Carson is talking about the land of dreams and you know, the ladder of opportunity. And obviously there is opportunity in the United States, but there was no mention of the racial backdrop. I also want to say that I think the media has overplayed the support of African-Americans for Hillary Clinton. You know, remember what happened when she was running against Barack Obama, and nobody knew if he was black or not. I mean, there was this whole conversation, is he black enough? Is he really black? And then as soon as Bill Clinton said something that was perceived as you know, pejorative at the least.
Yeah, Mr. Clinton, the putative first black president. Yeah,
right. You know, they abandoned her for Barack Obama before they even knew who Barack Obama was. So I think that it's the easy story is that black people are for Hillary Clinton. I think there are more cracks in that foundation than we have thought.
And Richard Cross, I was taken, when you think about the issues that the Democrats took up in the debate that we talked about here on Maryland Morning a few weeks ago, income inequality, Wall Street reform, trade,
guns,
immigration, climate change. These are things that the Republicans took up, but there are certain things that they didn't take up,
right?
Like guns, like campaign finance reform, like college affordability. What should we read into the topics that the Republicans chose to emphasize last night?
Well, it serves the Republican agenda for the candidates, all of the candidates, to put forth the argument that President Obama has been a failure, that there's weakness overseas with foreign policy, that the economy is broken. That serves the narrative. If you're Republican, you want the sky is falling type of message out there.
Here's Ron Paul. He's talking to Marco Rubio about spending too much money on, of all things, the military.
Point that I'd like to make about the tax credits. We have to decide what is conservative and what isn't conservative. Is it fiscally conservative to have a $1 trillion expenditure? We're not talking about giving people back their tax money. He's talking about giving people money they didn't pay. It's a welfare transfer payment. So here's what we have. Is it conservative to have $1 trillion in transfer payments, a new welfare program that's a refundable tax credit? Add that to Marco's plan for $1 trillion in new military spending, and you get something that looks to me not very conservative. Thank you.
Governor. And Rand Paul even talked about income inequality as being one of the biggest problems we face. That seems to me to be an about-face 180-degree turn from the last time. I mean, last time we had Mr. Romney talking about the 47%.
Well, remember that Paul is more libertarian, so some of his philosophy came into play last night, too, I think. for sure, they're having to acknowledge some of these issues, income inequality, for example, but they have a whole new take on how to resolve the problem, mostly by repealing everything that has been enacted during the Obama period, essentially, is their answer to everything.
Yeah, and they listed a few things. You know, and Sherry Parks, you brought this up right at the beginning of this conversation this morning. Is there a battle for the soul of the Republican Party? Here's Rand Paul saying, you know, what does it really mean to be conservative?
Well, and the loser last night seemed to be Wall Street. And it was interesting. I had to remind myself that I was watching the Republican debate because there were a lot of jabs taken at Wall Street. They actually said the word with the Wall Street Journal banner right behind them. And I thought that was really interesting. A lot of them, if they had an up from poverty story, were definitely putting it out there. And I mean, it was Wall Street versus Main Street, and Wall Street lost last night.
Yeah, interesting. And Richard Cross, the narrative on Jeb Bush was that he needed last night to be his big breakthrough moment. This is like the third or fourth time that Jeb Bush needed last night to be his big breakthrough moment. Did he have it?
I don't think so. I think when I look at Jeb Bush, he reminds me a lot of his father. He's very soft-spoken. I think he'd rather be teaching a graduate symposium rather than being on the stage with that debate last night. I think he tries his best. He just, it's just not something he's comfortable doing.
That's so interesting because people say the same thing about President Obama.
They do.
Mm-hmm. He's the law professor.
The constitutional law.
He's lecturing the United, the people of the United States. Shep, how about Marco Rubio? There were no, it might have been a softball question to Dr. Carson about discrepancies in his autobiography, but there were no inquiries whatsoever on Mr. Rubio's personal finances, which has been called into question.
Not specifically, but he was questioned a little bit about how responsible he was with general financial matters. So I think the context was talking about the budget, the national budget, but some of it was kind of a hint that he had personal issues too. They didn't delve into them deeply. I think this was just not the night to do that.
Mm-hmm. And Sherry Parks, I was taken that Mrs. Fiorina used the phrase "taking our government back."
You know, several times she did that.
Maybe, and that was redolent of Sarah Palin in the 2012 contest. I mean, what was your reaction to that?
Oh, take our government back from whom is always the question.
And, who stole it? And it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. They are not going to debate again until the middle of December, so there's a good rest for the Republicans. The Democrats
and for
are,
us.
Yeah. But thank you all for your time this morning. Always great to see you, and we appreciate it. And we will have you back and continue this conversation until at least November of next year.
Thank you.
E.R. Shipp is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and associate professor and journalist in residence at Morgan State University. Dr. Sherry Parks is the associate dean in the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland. Richard Cross, a former press secretary and speechwriter for Bob Ehrlich when he was in Congress and when he served as governor of Maryland. He blogs at Cross Purposes. The next debate is on Saturday night. Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley will debate in Des Moines, Iowa. It will be broadcast on CBS. I'm Tom Hall. Next up on this broadcast, an icon of American jazz, the great Ellis Marsalis, joins me live from New Orleans. He's playing at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum on Saturday night. We'll have a preview coming up a little later here on Maryland Morning.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now back to the show.
The legendary pianist and teacher Ellis Marsalis is coming to town this weekend. He'll be helping the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture celebrate an important milestone, their 10th anniversary. He'll be playing a concert at a gala at the museum on President Street in Baltimore on Saturday night. The influence of Ellis Marsalis on the history of American jazz is substantial. He is the patriarch of America's first family of jazz, which includes his sons, Winton and Branford, and he has taught many other jazz musicians in his long career as an educator, including the pianist Harry Connick Jr. and the trumpet player Terrence Blanchard. In 2011, the National Endowment for the Arts awarded Mr. Marsalis and his family a Jazz Master's designation. The first time that a group had ever been given that award by the NEA. I am pleased to welcome Ellis Marsalis to the program, who joins us on the phone from New Orleans. Good morning, sir. Thank you so much for your time.
Welcome to the call.
So, before we begin talking about you and your amazing career, I do want to ask for your reaction to the passing of Alan Toussaint, another icon in the New Orleans jazz scene. Did you know Mr. Toussaint? Were you close? And how would you assess his significance in the history of jazz, particularly in New Orleans?
Well, I've known Alan for years. In fact, we were both born in the same neighborhood, an area called Gertown. I didn't know him then, but it was a shock to me to hear that he had passed. The last time I saw him was at an award ceremony. The mayor of the city of New Orleans gave out awards to different people in the city that it was determined had made contributions to the city. But I think it's kind of ironic because at that particular ceremony, I spoke with Alan. We were sitting at the same table, and I asked him, had he done a biography? And he said, well, no, he hadn't. And I said, well, maybe you should consider it, because whenever you pass, people are going to write whatever they want to write, and you won't have a chance to correct it, not really knowing that within, you know, the next, like, year or so, he would be gone. But we didn't really function in the same musical arena.
Right.
Alan had the, how can I call it? Seems like the ability to articulate the culture in the popular music arena, which related to his personal experiences. You know, one of the pieces that he composed called Night People, which reflected watching people. They're like, you know, night people hanging out, waiting for something to happen. And that plus working in the coal mines, I forgot, it might have been Lee Darcy. I don't remember who he wrote it for. And I spent 3 years with the Al Hurt band, and one of the Al Hurt's major hits was Jabba, which Alan Toussaint wrote. And there's two others that were hits for Al. I don't know if Alan wrote both of them. One was called Sugar Lips, and the other is called Cotton Candy.
Yeah, I remember Java. Da 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 dum bum ba da 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 dum ba da da ba da dum ba da 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 dum. And of course, your impact in New Orleans and far beyond is in the arena of jazz rather than pop music. You have six sons; four of them are musicians. One of your sons, who decided not to pursue music but pursue photography, Ellis Marsalis III, actually lives here in Baltimore. You are Ellis Marsalis II. Did you grow up in a musical household? Was your dad a musician?
No, man. None of my people. They couldn't carry a tune in a bucket. You know, there was no... as far as our children were concerned, most, if you want to look at talent and heritage, most of that would come from my wife's side of the family. You know, her uncle was Wellman Burrow, who was the bassist for Duke Ellington for many years. And there's a clarinetist on her mother's side named Alphonse Picou, who popularized a clarinet solo from a march in a traditional jazz arena. And there were other, you know, cousins that were players, but on my side, there was nothing.
Well, your kids certainly come by it honestly one way or the other. Here's a little clip from a tune called Heart of Gold, written by one of your sons, Delfeo.
Right.
So a lot of musician friends of mine, they shy away from teaching their own children, but you didn't seem to ever do that. How did you handle that family dynamic when you were giving early instruction to your kids, you know, four of whom ended up pursuing the same career you did?
Well, it was, I'm trying to figure the best way to explain that. I can understand anybody not really wanting to teach their kids. But see, in my case, I was on the faculty of a high school, a public high school called the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts. And four of them attended that school. Three of them attended the school during the time I was on the faculty. So I had a jazz group that I developed, and also there was a sight singing class, which was a part of the curriculum. So in a way, I guess you could say I taught at least three of my sons by proxy, I guess.
Yeah. It wasn't all in your living room necessarily. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So yeah. It wasn't, you know, like a Socratic circle of the kids gathering around and dad teaching them. I think the greatest contribution I think I was able to make, aside from whatever they got at school, was that I knew when to get a good teacher for them on their particular instrument, because a lot of people who play instruments, they're not necessarily good teachers.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Marsalis, thank you so much for your time this morning. We appreciate it, and we hope you have a great trip to Baltimore when you play this weekend. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Ellis Marsalis will appear at the gala celebration of the Reginald F. Lewis Museum on Maryland African American History and Culture Saturday night, when the museum fets itself on the occasion of its 10th anniversary. The current special exhibition at the Lewis Museum features the work of Ruth Starr Rose. It's called Revelations of African American Life in Maryland and the World. It just opened last month, and it'll be here until April. That's it for us today here on Maryland Morning. On Friday, Joan Jacobson joins us to talk about a special report she's written for the Able Foundation on one of the Baltimore Housing Authority's signature initiatives, Vacants to Values. The Able Foundation is releasing the report in just about 10 minutes, and Joan will be here Friday to tell us what she has found. We'll also talk about mentoring with the president and CEO of Big Brothers Big Sisters of the Greater Chesapeake, and WYPR's Mary Rose Madden will talk about what she's found in her reporting on the frazzled relationship between the police and the African American community. That's all coming up Friday morning here on Maryland Morning. Until then, for Nathan Sterner, I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.